Coming up on this week's book show, best-selling YA author Andrea Buchanan lost her mind while crossing the street one blustery March morning. The cold winter air triggered a coughing fit and she began to choke. When the coughing finally stopped, she thought it was over, but she could not have been more wrong. Her new memoir is entitled The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. Andrea Buchanan on this week's book show. Tuesday afternoons at 3, Thursday evenings at 8:30 via podcast and anytime at WAMC.org. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Andrea Buchanan is the co-author of the million-selling Daring Book for Girls series, an empowering set of how-to manuals for girls with a sense of adventure. Her YA novel, Gift, is a sci-fi story that comes with its own fully playable Minecraft map, that was named one of Kirkus Review's best books of 2012. But her new memoir, The Beginning of Everything, recounts her harrowing experience with a real-life neurological mystery after a coughing fit led to brain trauma and months of cognitive impairment. Again, the name of the new book is The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. It is a pleasure to welcome Andrea Buchanan to this week's book show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just looking at the subtitle itself, The Year I Lost My Mind, there is a specific date that you lost your mind. Bring us to that day.
Yeah, it was March of 2015. I had the flu. I was very sick, but left the house to go have brunch with a friend, and I coughed in the middle of the street. And unbeknownst to me, ruptured my dura mater, the thick covering that covers the brain and spinal cord, causing my cerebrospinal fluid to leak out. But I wouldn't know that for a while.
Give us an idea of what cerebrospinal fluid is and the role that it plays, why it's so important.
Our brains and spinal cord are bathed in this special fluid, cerebrospinal fluid, that is created in the ventricles of our brain once a day, usually in the dead of night. And it's constantly circulating, and it's held in place by this tough covering called the dura mater. The cerebrospinal fluid itself is almost like a little circulatory system, a lymphatic system for the brain, cleansing it, bathing it, getting rid of waste, that sort of thing. But it also keeps our brains afloat. And if any of that fluid leaks out, our brains can sink in our skulls, and that causes intense pain and sometimes neurological symptoms as well.
I want to get into what happened and obviously what the book is about. But let us talk about where you were in your life when this happened in 2015. You are a writer. You've been writing, you've written novels, young adult work as well, and things were going okay.
Yeah.
So how does this affect where you are in your life when this particular incident happens?
Well, it's interesting that this all started when I was crossing the street at a literal crossroads, because in many ways I was at a crossroads in my life. My kids were 12 and 15. I was, you know, writing, having a career as a writer, but I was also in the process of getting a divorce. And so this was a time of great change, identity shift in my life, lots of changes in self all over the place as my kids were becoming their teenage selves. And I was trying to figure out how to navigate our life with a new family configuration and what I would do after being married for 20 years. So, yeah, this came at a time when it was really important for me to be able to think clearly. And yet, with my CSF leak, I was robbed of that. I was in constant pain. If I was upright for more than 15 minutes, I really couldn't think clearly. I couldn't pay attention clearly. I couldn't remember things from day to day, from moment to moment, at a time when I really needed to be able to function and be at my best for my kids and for the new direction my life was headed in. I wasn't able to be.
As you said a moment ago, you weren't aware till later as to what happened. So for 9 months, your brain is basically sinking in your skull because that fluid is leaking out.
Yes.
At what point in that time did it become diagnosed?
Well, it was interesting because I actually had a name for this fairly early on. The main symptom of a CSF leak, the classic presentation, is what's called a positional headache, a headache that gets better when someone lays down and worse when they stay up. And many doctors now are aware enough to be able to identify that. So between that, my symptoms, my presentation, and some MRIs that I had done, I had a diagnosis fairly early on, or at least a suspected diagnosis. What was difficult, though, was finding treatment. Because even though I was living in Philadelphia with access to all this world-class medical care, there were no specialists there who actually were able to treat it, other than symptomatically. I had to go to experts at Duke University in North Carolina before I was able to find somebody who had the technique, the ability, and the skill to actually fix it.
Because up until the point where you get to Duke, which we'll talk about in a moment, but up until that point, you're baffling doctors. You are the patient on house or the good doctor that the doctors are all sort of conferring about, wondering, well, what's wrong with Andrea?
Yeah. And also, this is actually a treatable condition and it's not all that rare, but because many doctors don't encounter it, it does seem baffling. And because so many of the symptoms are, I mean, who doesn't get a headache sometimes, right? So many of these things are invisible and they rely on believing your patient to be a reliable narrator as they report their symptoms to you. So it was a little baffling. And the first line of treatment for something like this is to rest, to have caffeine, to have an epidural blood patch, which is an injection of blood in the low part of your spine, which can help in some cases, but definitely doesn't cure it. So it just took a long time to get to a place where I was dealing with doctors who were, world-renowned experts in treating this.
Where does the fluid go? It's leaking. Where is it going?
Into your body, basically.
But it's the position of the brain that is causing the pain and the cognitive issues, correct?
Yes. Yeah. When your brain doesn't have enough fluid, and it's part of the reason why you feel better when you lay down and worse when you stand up, because gravity is affecting you. Your brain is sinking in your skull. It's pressing on nerves. It's compressing things. It's not able to function in its ideal state because there's not enough fluid surrounding it.
When you look at the time that you are trying to figure out what's wrong with you, you are in a great deal of pain. This pretty much brings your life to a halt, doesn't it?
Yes.
Give us a sense of how so and what an average horrible day would be like.
Well, on a good day, I could have a cumulative amount of maybe 45 minutes of upright time. That's not all at once. That's just scattered moments, added up throughout the day. Because being upright for more than 15 minutes at a time would bring on the unrelenting headache and cognitive dysfunction, inability to think clearly. So most of the time I was flat on my back, not leaning on a pillow or anything. You had to be completely flat. Because after a time, even being flat doesn't bring relief from the pain. The pain kind of becomes its own cycle. On a bad day, I would be flat in bed for the whole day, maybe get up to, spend a few minutes making dinner and lying on the floor while I wait for the pasta to boil, getting back up to stir the pasta and serve it to my kids, and then going back upstairs to lay flat again.
Andrea Buchanan is our guest. The name of the book is The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. A great deal of confusion around all of this while you were suffering, correct?
Yes.
And loneliness, you write.
Pain is very isolating. It's hard to understand someone else's pain, and pain is so invisible, from the outside. It's hard to communicate it to other people. I always tell people, trying to explain your pain is like trying to tell somebody about a dream you had. It's relevant to you. It's meaningful to you, but it's not meaningful to the listener, even though they've had the experience of having a dream and understanding what it's like to find a dream meaningful. It's just very personal and very specific, and it's very isolating and lonely and scary.
You write about this in the book, and you mentioned a moment ago that while this particular condition is not extremely rare, there aren't a lot of doctors who know exactly what it is or how to treat it. But also in this equation is the fact that it affects people differently depending on where the tear is, correct?
Yes, I mean, it can affect people differently. You know, some people have comorbid disorders that, so they're connective, they might have a connective tissue disorder, so they might be leaking from more than one place. Some people, you know, their dura is more elastic and it can withstand changes in pressure more. And so maybe they don't suffer as many of the cognitive issues or neurological issues. Some patients with this can even experience coma. It's just a range of experiences that depend on the person and how significant their leak is and the particulars of their bodies.
Did the flu have anything to do with the tear in your dura mater?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, in the series of events that led up to this, it seems like something that might be significant. You know, I had this high fever. I had, you know, so my body was stressed. Perhaps I had, more fluid in my system at the time. And then coughing on top of this, you know, fever situation. It might have just been, you know, the right place, the right time for this unfortunate thing to happen. Maybe the fever had nothing to do with it. We can't really know for sure.
At the point where you were going to the doctors and they were they giving you any temporary relief?
It was mostly symptomatic. You know, the first doctors I saw recommended that I go home and lay down for the, you know, 3 days straight, that I drink as much caffeine as possible and eat salty foods. They said Diet Coke and Doritos. And I thought, I was born to do this. I can do that. That's no problem. but, you know, those things, you know, drinking a lot of fluids, especially caffeine and having salty foods, those things might temporarily, you know, dilate your blood vessels, make you retain fluid. You know, the idea being just to get as much fluid in there as possible. But those aren't long-term fixes. There were other things I could do when I was leaking it. If I had to be upright to walk to the store, or go to a parent-teacher conference or something, you can wear abdominal binders to kind of put some applied pressure on your dura, on the spine. You can take migraine medications for the secondary headache you might develop due to the leak. But all of those, they don't even mask the symptoms, really. They just help you have some semblance of an upright life for small periods of time.
Meanwhile, you're a mom, though.
Yeah.
So how are you dealing with all that?
It was tough. I did a lot of what I used to call, when my kids were little, the laying down game. I would just, you know, they would do their homework in bed while I was laying down, or I would go lay down with them in the living room while they did their thing. I tried to be as present as I could with them while still accommodating, you know, my need to be flat a lot of the time. You know, a lot of things were made possible via the internet. We were able to order groceries and have food delivered. And I relied on the kindness of friends, parents of my kids' friends who were able to help them get to school and get to the extracurricular activities they had. But it was tough. And I worried about them feeling the loss of me as I was feeling the loss of myself during this time when I felt I needed to be especially present for them.
One of the things that you write about, and I'm hoping you can address, is this idea you did not always feel that you were taken seriously as a patient. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
And do you feel that was gender related?
I do. I mean, I do feel as though it is hard to be taken seriously as a woman, especially when you're dealing with male doctors. And especially as a woman of a certain age with a kind of invisible symptom like pain. I mean, head pain is difficult to figure out the source of in general, but it can also look like anxiety. It can look like stress. It might not be fair for a medical professional to see, like, oh, you're a woman, you're 43, you're going through a divorce, you have a headache, you're stressed. But that's where they might go first. But it is frustrating if you happen to be a person for whom a headache is not stress related, but, you know, due to an actual, I mean, physical tear that's fixable if somebody would actually pay attention to it.
How long do you feel that you went before it was paid attention to?
Well, I was seen at one hospital and we kind of ran out of options after I had my first epidural blood patch there. I went to a different hospital in Philadelphia that had a headache center, and the doctors there had experience with CSF leak patients. But again, the treatments were symptomatic, and it was, you know, a few months there before I said, I can't live like this. I need to do something. But I was also really concerned, was my case serious enough to travel to visit some expert? Maybe it didn't warrant that kind of investigation. And then finally, one of the neurologists told me at an appointment that they just attended a conference and seen Dr. Linda Gray from Duke speak, and they thought, oh, this sounds just like my patient. And they told me that's where you need to go, because that's where they can fix you.
So when you went to Duke, how did life change? Was it almost immediate?
It was unusual to describe all my strange symptoms that had seemed fairly unbelievable to the doctors I'd encountered, and have these doctors say, oh, yeah, no, that's what we see all the time. I was normal there to them. Instead of being doubted, I was believed instantly. What I was telling them lined up with their experience with other patients who had been there. And even when they weren't able to find the source of my leak, they were able to treat it based on all of their years of experience with people who have leaks like mine.
It's my understanding it can never be fully cured. Is that correct?
I'm not really sure. You know, if there's little research done on spinal CSF leaks in general, there's almost no research done on what the recovery process is like and what the relapse rate is like. I've been volunteering with the Spinal CSF Leak Foundation and for their Leak Week back in March to raise awareness about spinal CSF leaks. I had the chance to speak to a number of patients, and their stories were very interesting to me because they both had had leaks that lasted a long time, years in their cases. They were fixed, and then years later, they relapsed and had to be treated all over again. So it's unclear. The doctor that I see at Duke has told me that in his experience, if you're 2 years out, 3 years out, 4 years out from your procedure, from your patching, and you're showing no symptoms, it's very unlikely that a leak could happen again, but he won't rule it out.
And you're at that point now.
I'm now a little over 2 years since my procedure at Duke, and I'm almost back to 100%.
So when it comes to the idea of a leak, this is a very small tear, isn't it?
Yes.
Picking that up in any normal way of imaging is extraordinarily difficult.
It's very tricky. Even when people have iatrogenically caused spinal CSF leaks, such as women who have epidural anesthesia in childbirth, sometimes those needles can pierce the dura and cause a CSF leak. And it's from that tiny, tiny needle point that it causes these kind of levels of pain. And even though physicians know exactly where that needle went in, it is still sometimes hard to actually repair that site. It's tricky. So when something is a spontaneous tear or a tear due to, you know, thin connective tissue, that's even harder to locate and stitch up because, you know, a needle piercing is a little bit neater than a organic tear.
Andrea Buchanan is our guest. The name of her book, The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. This is The Book Show. We've been talking a lot about illness, but let us talk about your writing life. Because at what point, as you're going through this, or even through the treatment, did you think, okay, I want to write and tell this story?
Well, it was interesting because being sick with this really robbed me of the ability to create story, to understand story. I couldn't pay attention to things long enough to make sense of stories. And so it was very unsettling for me trying to find the narrative here. My brain was a brain in search of stories. I was constantly puzzling, trying to find my way back to the beginning of this to figure out where it could have started and how I might be able to end it. When I had my first blood patch in the summer of 2015, I had about a month where I had some clarity. And I was asked to write for the Rumpus Literary Magazine's Letters in the Mail program, where they send letters, physical letters from writers to their subscribers. So I decided to write about this. And that was really the first time that I'd kind of resurfaced, come up for air with this whole experience and had time to reflect on it. So in this brief period of lucidity, I wrote about it. But then my health declined again, and it wasn't until after I had my procedure done at Duke and was well into the first year of my recovery process that I was able to really start writing about this specifically again. And it was challenging.
The book is so compelling and beautiful in its story. I assume that comes in hindsight, in looking back at what you went through?
Yeah, part of the challenge of this was how to, first of all, how to account for that time when I wasn't there, when I felt like myself, the way I think of myself, was not fully present. I wasn't journaling, I wasn't writing, I wasn't able to record these things as they happened. So I had to research my own life and do some first-person reporting on myself by looking through emails that I'd sent to families about updates about my condition, through my medical records that were available to me online, through text messages that I had saved, through the scraps of writing that I'd done here and there in moments of lucidity. And so having to go back and reconstruct that, it was actually a chance in a lot of ways for me to process some of that experience for the first time, because I had been absent for it. I'd been so consumed by pain, the physical experience of pain, that I wasn't able to fully think about it or register how existentially scary it was to feel as though I wasn't there. So the writing process was intense in a lot of ways.
Was there memory loss?
No. Although in looking through my old writing, I came across things that I did not remember writing at all during the time that I was sick, that I'd written down in a fit of inspiration or something. So it wasn't exactly memory loss, but while I was sick, I felt like the self that was me, the self that I think of as being myself, was this tiny, tiny speck way, way back in the depths of my mind, and just was I was like a passenger in the car that my brain and body were driving. And so I was observing myself in a way from a distance. So it wasn't exactly memory loss, but just in writing about it and trying to create a narrative around it, I had to confront the immediacy of it that I'd missed the first time around.
And it seems, obviously, that it's the debilitation of pain, too,
yeah,
of what pain can do to you.
Yeah.
I also know your degrees are in piano performance from both Boston and San Francisco conservatories. Were you able to play at all?
I did. I write about it in the book. At a certain point, when I was really struggling with this leak and with this pain, I wasn't upright at all for much of the time. I sat down at the piano one day just to see if I could play at all. And it was so heartening to me that I still had this muscle memory, this implicit memory that I could play through some repertoire that I'd learned years ago. It was still there. Somewhere inside me, I was still me. And then when I was recovering, I didn't have much of a game plan from my doctors or anything like that in terms of how to recover neurologically from this experience if my patches held, if my procedure worked. So I did a lot of, once I was able to read again and really be able to retain information, I started doing a lot of reading about neuroplasticity, about the brain's capacity for healing and for change. And a lot of the reading that I did suggested that patients who did practical life exercises like stacking cups, like wiping counters, this is people in patients who had experienced stroke or other brain impairment, cognitive injuries, those people showed so much improvement just from doing these fine motor skills that involved intense concentration for them. And I thought, well, that sounds to me like what's involved in practicing piano. And so I returned to the piano, and that became kind of my brain rehab. Just doing it for at first minutes at a time, because it was hard for me to sit up that long. And then eventually increasing that time and learning, going through old repertoire, learning new repertoire. It was probably more than anything else, aside from time and sleep, the thing that made me feel like my brain was reconnecting itself.
As I mentioned, the subtitle was The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. So that was part of the finding yourself.
Yes.
After the procedure, and once you have the medical team, at what point do you feel, okay, I'm back to normal? I'm me again.
It's a tricky question, because I don't think I can return to normal. I think I can return to baseline in terms of neurological function, physical ability to be upright, that sort of thing. But I think returning to, quote, normal is an impossibility. I thought of that year after I had my procedure in January of 2016. I began that year as my year zero. like a starting over. So now I'm in year two. If you, at least for me, I think if I'm trying to compare myself to where I used to be before this happened, it can be frustrating because recovery is slow and it happens in real time, and real time is excruciatingly slow. But if I can think of myself as starting this new phase, then I'm much more free to appreciate where I am right now.
Andrea Buchanan's new book is The Beginning of Everything, The Year I Lost My Mind and Found Myself. It is published by Pegasus. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program, Bookmark Us for Next Week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.